a lot of times when people are writing about art and it's and they're writing about what they're looking at, they're writing about what, you know, it's like a formalistic description of what the artwork is. And there, you know, there's a lot of kind of academic jargon in there. It's a very shallow investigation. Whereas what I'm always more interested in is, what is the artist trying to convey? What is the reference point to this? You know, what is the artist talking about? If the artist is talking about something interesting, what is that? And let's talk about that, and talk about how he's talking about this subject, rather than talking about the other thing. Because then all of a sudden, just the artwork. Because then all of a sudden, you get access to the interesting art. And artists are people who are not that great at communicating verbally sometimes, and who choose to discuss these really exciting things through objects. But, you know, as a writer, I feel like it's my obligation to kind of like translate the object into what the artist is trying to talk about, and try to get more at the ideas and less at like the formal kinds of things. Reviews are not always the best way to write about anything, because what happens, so if you look at like the art landscape again, you look at, you know, let's say New York Times, very influential kind of publication for art reviews because it's the New York Times. Everybody reads the New York Times. It has this like imprimatur of the paper of record. That means that, you know, every gallery that gets written about is going to put their review up in their, you know, on their front desk. They're going to be sending it out to all their collectors. It doesn't even matter necessarily who the critic is who's writing for the Times. It's the New York Times. The only exception is Roberta Smith, who's even bigger than the New York Times in the art community. So that's quite the feat. But otherwise, a review is really kind of a dutiful going to the show, describing the show, maybe saying if it's good or not, often not saying if it's good or not. You're just like kind of describing it. You know, what you're doing is you're doing something that is a little bit outdated, because what you could also do is show pictures, you know?
Reviews in Estonian, about Estonian exhibitions, and they are written from Estonian journalists, then they are all describing the exhibition, and there is I think 80% of their reviews are just describing the exhibition they see.
That's completely, that has been rendered obsolete. it really is, the review has had two components. One of them is the, you know, praise or blame kind of component of criticism, and one is the describe it for somebody who hasn't been there. When there's the, you know, when you have Instagram, you don't really need to describe it to people who aren't there, or when galleries have, you know, really, you know, kind of like comprehensive websites and they post all these images, it's not so necessary. So then all of a sudden, the important component of the review becomes the praise and blame part. Now that means, you know, negative reviews are the most successful things you could possibly write. A lot of times somebody will, you know, assign a review just to get the negative review. It's like this hot take idea. I've seen this going back to ArtNet, which is kind of my fun little foil for thinking about how to do irresponsible art journalism. They once reviewed the Venice Biennale, I think 2 hours after it opened to the press, they wrote a review saying, like, this is the worst Biennale ever. And I was like, I saw it on my phone, and I was like, maybe, you know, I'd seen three things in the Biennale. And I was like, how is it possible that you can write? And it was a huge success in terms of traffic. It was like this gigantic success. But I was thinking, like, how can you be a responsible art journalist and write a review of this gigantic multi-site exhibition with tons of really complicated ideas and just dismiss it in the headline as saying it's, like, stupid or something? That, you know, the praise and blame thing is, it only really works if you have something to actually say about it. You know, if you really believe that there's something that you can say about a show that is important, then it's a great format to write a review and say something about it. But there are very few reviews that actually have something to say. You know, you don't really have, often there's this idea of a forced march of like going to the place and just doing a pro forma thing. And reviews, as a result, are the worst performing things on the web. They're just really terrible. The only people who read them are the gallery, the artist, the artist's immediate family, maybe the gallerist's immediate family. And it's just, it disappears. It's quite frankly a waste of time. So if there's a show that is interesting to write about, if there is a review angle that has some kind of like kernel of an idea in there that we can really dig into at length, then we can write a piece like that. Otherwise, maybe we'll do an interview with the artist, or if the artist is not available, then the curator, but usually the artist, very rarely, like we only do curator interviews if like the artist is dead, I guess, if we're talking about a show. But when you're interviewing an artist, then the way to do it is you make it very pointed and you talk about exactly what the ideas are in the show that you want to get out there that you think are so exciting. And then that way you kind of bypass the art and you get to the ideas, which is where, you know, I'm fundamentally mostly interested in, is in the ideas. And then, you know, if a review is too much of a kind of, it doesn't justify a review, and an interview is not the way to do it, then you can also use other forms of a delivery system. You could write like a listicle about it. Now, listicles are the kind of like the most depraved, cheap form of, they're like the junk food of writing, because you're breaking something down into 10 reasons why, blah, 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 blah. At the same time, it's a very effective delivery system for content. And it's a delivery system for ideas. And so I think I've even written reviews of the Venice Biennale. That's like 10 things to know about the Venice Biennale. It makes it so much faster, so much more readable. And that doesn't mean each one of those 10 things can be like quite a hefty chunk of text. It can be, I write pretty long reviews, and if you chop it into like a kind of a list, then that gives you, it's a fun format. It gives you a little bit more latitude, and you can bring in other ideas, and you can, you're not really held to the marathon of doing a sustained kind of review, where you're like, you know, narrating a walk through a biennial. So I think that's one of the fundamentally important things about web journalism, is that nothing is holding you to the review format. The review format is not so effective. It doesn't, on social media, it doesn't do that well unless it's a very bad review. A very good review, if it's counterintuitive, could do well. But things that succeed on social media are often things that over-deliver. And that's where the that's where, you know, you can use pretty much any format you want. And if you say that you're going to 10 reasons why you should see this show or something like that, and then if you write something really interesting and well written and over deliver on the promise of the listicle, over deliver on the promise of this kind of like cheap format, and have it be something that is really meaningful and substantial, then that's the kind of thing that gets shared around like crazy, because that that is giving people exactly what they want. And what they want is to read something, be engaged in it, and not have it be a chore, and then still get out of it the things that they that kind of open their eyes and are transformative. Gallery statements are often like, you can look at them for a long, long, long time and really try to figure out what is happening here. And then like you'll see that somebody is writing something, but the feeling is that somebody had to write something, and so they tried to figure out something to say, but they tried to make the artist happy, and they tried to make it sound really high-minded. So what you get is something that has a lot of these kinds of academic words, and that's like, I think the worst outcropping of the whole October development is that in order to sound smart, you have to use really theoretical words or words that are very jargony or niche, and that becomes it makes for something that's not really readable. And I don't think that it's, you don't have to avoid big words. I mean, that's not, and there's no reason to avoid big ideas. The thing is that it's often the thing that gets lost is the impulse to communicate. And people are writing, this is a trap that you can fall into, is that instead of trying to actually communicate something beyond the page that you're writing it on, you can get stuck in this trap of just trying to communicate something with the page that you're writing it on, where you're like, okay, does that make enough sense? Can I get away with that? Are they going to understand that? And if not, maybe I'll make it a little more vague, and then nobody can understand the meaning, and I can't be wrong.
Do you have a target person that helps you pitch in that sense? I mean, I've heard some, there's a journalist here, for instance, who says that he takes an aunt of his that lives right on the south border of Estonia, so that's kind of as far into the sticks as possible. And his article, he writes to her, and he thinks if she can understand it, then the whole of Estonia can. Do you have a similar device?
I like it when my dad says that he reads my articles. That's always
right.
That's always fun. I don't really have like a one person who I write to all the time. I do try to keep myself entertained when I'm writing it. So I think I try to write to
yourself.
Myself. Yeah, I try to write to myself, but I also I mean, that's another thing. I think it doesn't mean that you have, writing should not be, writing should always be on a peer-to-peer basis. You should not ever try to dumb things down or try to make something overly simplified. That's not the goal. The goal is just to have the emphasis be on communication, and really imagine you're talking to somebody that you respect. Like, this is my typical kind of when I have, you know, a colleague is writing anything from like a merchandising email to especially something that's like a merchandising email. You know, we write the merchandising copy for the emails as well. And sometimes like he'll say like, you know, like this is the greatest artwork you've ever seen. It's you know, like a fantastic deal. Come right down and get it. Like really trying to be like a car salesman, like trying to put himself in like the mindset of somebody seen in a movie who sells things or something like that. Because we're journalists and we have no idea how to do that. But what I tell him is like, just imagine that you are actually standing in a gallery with somebody who you know and respect and are telling them about this thing. How are you going to explain it to them in a way that they'll understand? Like that's, what is the, there's this great William Blake aphorism that said, truth, if explained so as to be understood, is universally believed. I think that's a great line, where the idea is that if you just like convey what you're trying to say in a way that's clear, then people will believe it. And you know, I don't think you necessarily have. And if you're going to refer to these kinds of ideas that are the October, you know, situation, just do it in a way that gives context. Don't assume familiarity. You know, don't overly assume familiarity. A little bit of a glossary can be very helpful. Even just like a forward parenthetical phrase. Like if you're talking about, I mean, any term, it's easy to bring it in and make it communicative. I think about the general audience. It's always great if you think you're communicating to the same audience that the major newspaper is, or the major, you know, cultural magazine. Story choice is really important. Think of the headline. Unfortunately, social media is a huge part of the way that news is distributed. And social media gives you two things. It gives you a headline and it gives you an image. And the image, luckily it's art, so you can have nice, pretty images pretty easily. The headline is the thing that is going to make or break an article. And this is just, in like, if you're writing for a newspaper, if you're writing for a magazine, you can have the most obscure headline that you want. You could have a two-word headline. You could have like, you don't even have to have a headline. If it's in the place that people expect to find a certain kind of art writing, and if it's delivered visually on the page in a way that's easy to understand, people will read it. They'll read it as part of, you know, just like going through that section of the publication. On the internet, you don't have any of that help. Every article is on its own. Every article lives and dies by its headline and its image. So when you're coming up with an article, it's always good, and this is just like kind of a general principle to make sure that you have a clear idea of what you want to do, is think, can you imagine what the headline is? Like, where are you going with this? Do you have something to say that is synthesized enough in your mind that you can figure out a way to express it in a way that will be interesting? And so if you can do that, that is helpful at the outset. Like, think, like, what do I want to talk to this person about? What do I want to, if I'm going to write a review, then what is my, like, I've seen the show, I've thought about it a lot, I want to do this thing, what am I going to write about? What's my perspective on this? And that, it can be a very clarifying way of thinking about your writing, because then if you know what you're going to say and you know how you're going to say it, then you can really kind of angle it. You can like, you can make it so that you get to what you want to get across without burying it, without having it be too indistinct. That's something that online journalism requires, is distinctiveness, is that it is that it has to be meaningful. It has to have a certain kind of urgency. It has to be it can't just be a pro forma kind of review, because that will die. So that's very important. Think of the headline and the direction that you want to go with the article. Then there are a number of formats that you can use. One that I use a lot is the Q&A. Now, Q&As are really good for a couple of reasons for online journalists. One is that if you are a staff of three people and you have a certain amount of of articles that you want to write per week, then writing a feature article in which you interview six people and you have six transcripts that you have to create, and then you have to weave all these quotes together, and then you have to fill it with kind of just like, you know, transitional writing, that takes a ton of time, and often it's not the most efficient way of doing things. That's like that kind of feature is the prestige form of writing, and it's harder to get that kind of space to do it. I encourage everybody at ArtSpace to really try to carve out time to do these kinds of features, because they're important. They're a great way of really investigating a subject, but the Q&A can be more targeted, and a Q&A can be a Q&A can accomplish a lot of editorial aims. Like, you can really, I mean, for instance, I just did this one with Hans Ulrich Obrist about, you know, the direction of painting, and I decided I'm going to talk to him about his engagement with painting over time, how he's seen artists like approach to painting change over the decades, and where he sees it now. And I thought that would be, that's better than a feature about this subject. It's stripped down purely to my questions and his answers. And it gives his view unvarnished. And one thing that I always think of as a journalist is, if in the course of doing reporting, I come up with something, or if I'm doing an interview and I get something, I don't want to be the only one who knows that. Everything that I'm doing in the course of writing this article that I think is worthwhile should be shared. There's no point in only doing one or two sentences from this really long, interesting interview and weaving it into something just because that's the format. I would much rather give the same access that I had with this interesting figure to all of the readers, and I think the Q&A format is very good at providing that, because all it is an introduction, questions, and answers. So how do you do an interview, a Q&A, that will be successful? And the first thing to do is, when you're interviewing somebody, figure out if there's something to talk to them about. Don't just interview anybody, you know, because they're there. You have to have both the subject and you have to have the topic. You have to know what it is that is important, that is urgent, that this person can tell you better than anybody else in the world, and something that is significantly interesting to your readership. And then you have to match that up. So the thing to do is to I mean, research is the most important part. Research is, if you think you should spend lots of time on research. If you're ever writing an article about somebody, you have to read everything that they've had written about them recently. You have to look back through their CV. You have to try to, you know, have a create like a chronology. Really understand this person. Understand their experiences. Hi, how are you? Oh no. And you should make sure that you have a very good idea of who this person is and what they've done and what they've said in the past. Then write your questions. And when you're writing your questions, the most helpful thing you can do is write them with a lot of context so that you're not just saying, so, you know, what are you working on today? The question should be, you've done this, you've done that, you've done all these things. Most recently, you've done this. What are you working on now? In like a Q&A, your questions should have as much content as the answers. You should be providing as much information. That has to. Otherwise, it's not as content rich. The questions are really a place to inject a viewpoint, to inject lots of important contextualizing information, and then you have the answer. And then you do the interview. Stick to your questions. It's easy to get kind of sidetracked. Try as much as you can to segue things back, but don't only also improvise and also follow the conversation as it's going. Then after it's done, you'll have no idea what you've got. You'll think you'll be totally wrong with how it went. You'll have the wrong impression. Then transcribe it. If you're lucky enough to have somebody to help you transcribe it, that's really a nice little luxury. But transcribing it yourself is really good because then you can go through and you can edit as you go. And it's very important that you make sure that what they're saying is communicating in the way that they mean to say it. So that means you want to edit out all of the conversational the you knows. You want to make it so it's a clean piece of like dialogue that effectively is conveying the idea. Editing of a Q&A is very, very important. You can cut certain things. Sometimes if it's too complicated and something is jumbled, you can string it together a little bit. As long as you're being very, this is my approach. It's as long as you're being very, very conscious that you are only amplifying and clarifying what this person is saying. Then you've got your Q&A, you put the introduction together, just a brief thing, and then you put it out there. Now, the second part of the whole Q&A process is you have to be prepared for the day after, because then the subject will have second thoughts, or it will have, I mean, if there's something interesting in the interview, keep it in there. Don't take it out. Don't take anything out of the interview. Keep it all in there. And then when they call you the next day saying that that they are, you know, and this only happens maybe like 1 out of 20 occasions where they're like, you know, my friend read this and can't believe that I said this, and like I wish I could take this thing out. Then at this point, this is when you have to be very diplomatic, but you have to make sure that your ultimate responsibility is to the reader. The historical explainer is always a really great piece. One thing that ArtSpace has a real advantage in is that because we're not news-based, we don't have to just write about the things that are in the news. We can write about things that happened, you know, 1,000 years ago for no good reason other than we're interested in it. Like, the most important thing as a writer is to always actually write about the things that you're interested in. If you're curious about something, if you have questions about something, write about it. People will, like, sense your enthusiasm, and they'll sense your engagement, and they'll sense that you're having fun or that you're being interested in what you're doing. So if there's, like, any historical moment that you want to know more about, then I always tell people to just go back, investigate it, and write about it in a way that answers your questions. You know, kind of like it's a great way to educate yourself in public. And you believe me, you will get a lot more out of it than you would if you just read the text. And if you're lucky, you'll get paid for it too. And that is, that's a really kind of actually surprisingly popular kind of article. And I keep on saying popular. I see how every single article on ArtSpace performs. I see every single piece of data about it. I see how many people read it. I see how many times it gets a page view. I see what percentage of these readers are new visitors who are coming to the site for the first time. I see what percentage of people leave the site after reading this article. I see how many minutes they spend on each article. There are lots of ways to see how these articles perform. And these kinds of historical deep dives that are answering like an authentic curiosity on the behalf of the writer do great. They get lots of readers and they get lots of time on page. People really spend the time. Like we just did this, we did a piece on Rosalind Krauss a little while ago. No reason, just because she's interesting, just because, you know, like, you know, this writer was asking me questions about her, and, you know, and I was like, if you're interested, why don't you do something? Do like a, you know, what did Rosalind Krauss do kind of thing. And it was, you know, it's like remedial education. It actually fills in a gap in the reader's understanding, and it did sensationally well. I mean, for a piece about like a... like an influential, you know, art critic, it was a big hit. People, the one thing that I've kind of come to appreciate from looking at these kinds of metrics is that the audience is pretty great. The people, readerships are, at least, you know, I'm lucky enough to have a good readership, but people do respond to good quality. They don't always respond to the crap that you think will get them to click on it. One kind of article that often really, really resonates with our audience is anything that is like a guide or that is like a how-to, something people are always looking for help and direction. And I mean, if you look at in book publishing, like the self-help industry is a gigantic thing. But in the art world, people just have lots of, it's tough to navigate it. There are lots of questions. I mean, should you go to art school? Should you, how do you start a career if you don't have gallery representation? Like, how do you do a studio visit? These kinds of articles that we've been doing that are just kind of altruistically spirited guides to actual questions people have are incredibly popular. Incredibly popular. There's just a built-in audience for it, and also they get shared like crazy. These kinds of articles are really, I mean, there can be a temptation to overindulge in this kind of like news you can use is the expression. But that is answering a need from the readership, and if you answer the readership's need, the readership will thank you. Another thing that the readership will thank you for is if you make them laugh. So that's like the, that is always like the way to I think in sorry, did somebody have a question? I think like in generally speaking, if you can do something, if you can educate the your readership through an article, if you can kind of entertain them and make them like smile a little bit, that's really useful. And the most important thing I think is that if you're talking about something really, really, really complicated and really, really, really smart, you should throw in some elements that are dumb. Throw in some things that are a little bit more lowbrow. Throw in something to kind of take the bite out of it a bit. Make it, make the medicine go down. And if you're writing about something that is really, really dumb for whatever reason, like dogs in galleries, then write about it as intelligently as you can. And if you have that kind of dichotomy between the seriousness of the topic and the self-seriousness of the approach, that is very, very appealing. That's like, you have to remember that, you know, when somebody is reading your piece, they are committing to spending time with you and your perspective. And you want to be hospitable. You want to make them feel at ease. You want them to be you want them to be engaged, and you want them to stick around. So treat them as a guest. Treat them kind of generously. And I feel like that will, your audience will reward you. If you're just, treat them as if they're not being forced to read what you're doing, but they've chosen it, and that, you know, you can be generous to them. Be a good host. And there's no substitute for real research. I would rather have lots of research put in on the front end and have a product come out that's like, you know, that's a Q&A rather than a feature, because it's the research that's going to make it compelling. I don't know if you guys know how to research an article, and that's a real, that's a challenge. I mean, how would I, okay, I'm kind of known for researching very thoroughly. So what I do is first thing I do is I plug the person into Google News and I read page after page after page of results to see what are the most recent things and how far back does this journalism trail go. And then when you find areas of interest, you just research them. You go down all the rabbit holes. You'll never know when you're like where you're going to find the thing that gives you like the insight that you're looking for. And really what you need to find is just what are the uncovered areas? What are the unasked questions? I used to, when I was covering art events for the New York Times and New York Magazine, I would go out to these like film premieres and book parties and, you know, gallery dinners and things like that. And I would always get provided with a list of names of all the celebrities who would be in this party. And or all the famous people, like, you know, all the artists and the writers and everything. And what I would do would be I would spend a lot of time researching every single one of these people and then finding what are the questions that nobody has ever asked them before about things that are important. And then they could be questions about things that had happened like 12 years before. And then I would go up to them and ask them the question at this party that had something to do with something totally different. I would ask, like, you know, at a film premiere, I would ask some politician about, you know, some unanswered question from like his, you know, 5 years ago. And that kind of research would always pay off because that was where the news was. That was where the value is. And it just takes a lot of time to find it. But the biggest favor you can do yourself is to really give a lot of time to research. And it's fun. You can go down all these rabbit holes, learn about things you never knew before. And then that's, and if you're a journalist like me, that's one of the only times when you get to read anything.